Welcome. This is Dr. Philip E. Stieg, Professor and Chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery at the Weill Medical College of Cornell University, New York Presbyterian Hospital, and I'd like to welcome you to How to Save Your Life. This week, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce Dr. Fabrizio Michelozzi, the Lewis Atterbury Stimson Professor and Chairman of the Department of Surgery at the Weill Medical College of Cornell University. Today, we are going to talk about diseases of your stomach and intestinal tract. How often have you said to friends and loved ones, "You're full of it"? Today, we're going to find out that that might be true. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Hello, and welcome to How to Save Your Life. I'm Dr. Philip Stieg, and today I'm talking with Dr. Fabrizio Michelazzi, the Lewis Atterbury Stimson Professor and Chairman of the Department of Surgery at Weill Medical College of Cornell University. It is a distinct honor and pleasure to have Dr. Michelazzi with us today. He is a world-renowned gastrointestinal surgeon with a strong expertise in the surgical treatment of gastrointestinal cancers and inflammatory bowel disease. He has written innumerable papers and book chapters numbering over 150. He has pioneered the development of important new surgical techniques. He has experience and expertise in treating Crohn's disease. He has edited a book on operative strategies in inflammatory bowel disease and produced 10 instructional movies for surgeons on how to manage these diseases. Now, being a gastrointestinal surgeon is a mouthful. A little bit about your background, Fabrizio. Obviously, by your accent, we can tell that you're not Irish. Can you explain to the listeners how you got to this country and how you got interested in this subject?
Phil, it's a real pleasure to be here with you today. It all started probably more than 30 years ago. I was in medical school, and I met an anesthesiologist from the States while I was in Italy, and where I'm from, and he invited me to come over and see how medicine is practiced here in the United States. And I got to tell you, I fell in love immediately with the way young physicians were trained in the States, which was fundamentally different from what really I was looking and seeing in Italy. And at that point, I decided that no matter what, I was going to come to the States and be trained here in the States. And as you know, in 1977, I came to New York, where I was trained at NYU. In surgery. And then from there, I wanted to be an academic surgeon, so I moved to the University of Chicago, where I stayed for 20 years, and I joined Weill Cornell 2 years ago in 2004.
But what was it that really hooked you about gastrointestinal disease? I mean, it's not, maybe it is more common than I really understand. What got you? Was it somebody you interacted with, a mentor?
Well, you know, I tell you, you're absolutely right. I was a mentor. And while I was in Pisa, even before going to medical school, I knew the chairman of surgery there. And I really thought that this guy could walk on water. And I decided, almost paradoxically, not to go to medical school for nothing else but to become a surgeon. So I knew that I was going to be a surgeon even before I got into medical school. And at that point, that mentor also played a very influential role in showing me the beauty of being, as you said, a mouthful, a gastrointestinal surgeon. And from the very moment, even before I attended the first class in medical school, I knew I was going to be a GI surgeon.
So let's touch a little bit on the importance of mentoring in medical school and in training these days. Is it an art form that exists? Is it gone because of the changes that have occurred in the way we deliver medicine? How important is it?
I think it's extremely important because if you're not a mentor, if you cannot inspire young minds and young people to follow in your steps, if you cannot infuse the enthusiasm for what we do today, our profession, whatever it is, medical profession or a lawyer or an engineer or whatever, is going to disappear. So you really have to infuse the enthusiasm for what we're doing. And you have to teach people and tell people that they will be as happy as we have been.
What's the future for your subspecialty? Do you find that medical students nowadays remain as attracted? You know, are they coming in like you, knowing that that's what they want to do? Or are we attracting different kinds of people to medical school?
No, I think it was probably, even then, a very atypical case. I knew that I wanted to be a surgeon even before going to medical school. But let's be honest, even in my times, 30 years ago, many medical students went into medical school not knowing how they would come out on the other hand. And I believe that by being in touch with different mentors, some became surgeons, some became internists, some became endocrinologists, some became neurosurgeons, etc., etc. Same thing today. And so to a certain extent, it's great 4 years in medical school because you are able to shop here and there for really what your appetite is. And you want to be in touch with different individuals and eventually want to emulate what the best mentors can show you. So I think it's extremely important to be a mentor. It's extremely important to really infuse, as I said, enthusiasm in the medical students, so that eventually they will be able to choose what will make them happier and more productive to our society.
It's clear from looking at your resume that you're totally dedicated to the education of medical students and residents. You've published over 150 articles. You've made all of these movies, instructional movies on how to do surgery. What do you think is happening with the restructuring and the work hour limitations in terms of resident education? How do we as educators in the field have to adapt?
Well, it's a very different from the times when you and I were residents. As you know, we were on call every other night, which meant that most likely we were in the hospital for 36 hours and then go home for 12. And we ended up working 110, 120, 125 hours a week. I think we had a great experience. I think we saw a lot of patients, a lot of operations, and we felt very comfortable. I think, on the other hand, that you and I probably fell asleep a few times here and there, maybe even sometimes examining patients. And I think that the patient today, the population today, has the right to have a physician who's alert, not tired, and therefore not liable to make mistakes that are probably more common when you're tired. So I'm fully in favor with the changes in limiting the working hours. Now, that obviously poses incredible problems for us, because we worked 120 hours a week for 5 years, and we were well-educated at the end of it. If we want to create physicians in the future who are as well-educated as we were at the end of our residence, we have to compress the training in 80 hours a week for 5 years. And so we have to teach smarter. We have to eliminate from the daily work of the residents things that are totally called service, you know, like blood drawings, like doing secretarial work, ordering x-rays, ordering labs, and follow through with this. There are some activities in a hospital that not necessarily need to be done by a physician, not necessarily need to be done by a resident. And residents in the hospital are there to learn how to be surgeons, how to be physicians at the end of the residency. And if we do that, I think we can educate our residents perfectly within the limitations of working hours.
So your message to the public then is that even though they have reduced work hours, we're not turning out people that have inferior technical skills as surgeons.
Oh, definitely. I think that the residents that we're turning out here, for instance, at Weill Cornell, I'm very proud of all of them. I would entrust my life into their hands, and I know that they are as well prepared as I was at the end of my residency.
Well, let's get back a little bit to how you spend, I presume, about 90% of your life. As I said, it's a mouthful, and for the rest of the show, we'll probably abbreviate it to GI surgery, but it's gastrointestinal surgeon. What does that mean? What do you do? What diseases do you focus on?
Well, it's a surgeon who deals with diseases of the gastrointestinal tract, which is the alimentary tract, which, you know, in common words, is the stomach and the intestine. And then there are a couple appendices, such as the pancreas, the liver, and so forth. But that's mainly it. And it's a surgeon dealing with these diseases. And the diseases are mainly either cancers or inflammatory, meaning an infection of some of those components.
And are there some common names for diseases that you deal with then? You know, the cancer is going to be a cancer, but in terms of the inflammatory infectious processes?
Well, as you said, cancer is going to be cancer. Everybody has had, unfortunately, friends or even relatives affected by cancer of the stomach, or cancer of the pancreas, or cancer of the colon or the rectum. When it comes to inflammatory disorders, so you're talking about, say, for instance, appendicitis, diverticulitis, or when you go to the chronic inflammations, you talk about Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis. So these are common ailments, and probably there are several hundreds, thousands of patients in the United States with any of one of these ailments.
I'm interested in diverticulitis. Is that something that gets worse as you get older?
Well, not necessarily, but definitely the older you get, the more are your chances of developing complications of diverticular disease. You know, first of all, we have to realize what is diverticular disease. you know, the colon, which is the second part of the intestine, the lower part of the intestine, the one that produces bowel movements, with time, like an old tire, may create little outpouchings. And these outpouchings are called diverticular disease. And if you really look at patients, say, 67 or 80, the majority will have some outpouchings, will have some diverticula. Only a percentage of these patients will develop diverticulitis, which is an inflammation, an infection of this diverticula. And the older you get, the more chances you have to develop diverticulitis, just because of the odds of living longer and the odds of an infection occurring in that site.
Is diverticulitis something that has to be treated surgically, or is there medical management for it before?
I think that most of the diverticulitis attacks are treated medically with antibiotics. But when it becomes a recurrent problem, whereby patients unfortunately suffer from a pain, fever on a recurrent matter every month, every other month, at that point, I think the surgery can cure the diverticular disease, restoring the patient to the quality of life that he or she deserves.
Can those outpouchings that you refer to in your intestinal wall, can they ever rupture and blow into the abdomen?
Yeah, there are more severe complications of diverticulitis, such as a rupture or the formation of an abscess or the formation of a communication with another organ, such as the bladder. All these things need to be treated surgically. Or another complication yet is bleeding, and they obviously require surgery.
Quickly, what are some of the symptoms that a patient would have that would suggest that they have this outpouching of their bowel that might lead them to see you or a gastroenterologist, a doctor who specializes in stomach diseases or intestinal disease?
The outpouching by itself is usually asymptomatic, so it doesn't give any symptoms. So patients don't know that they have it. Nowadays, with the important habit of getting screening colonoscopies after the age of 50 or so forth to rule out cancer, I think that we are diagnosing the outpouchings even if the patient doesn't have any symptoms. The symptoms usually occur either when there is a bleeding, and obviously patients are passing blood per rectum through the anus, or when there is an inflammation, in which case patients develop pain in the left side of the abdomen, and they may develop a little bit of nausea, vomiting, some fever. They just don't feel well. And at that point, I think that they really need to seek the attention of either a medical gastroenterologist or a GI surgeon.
It's time to take a short break. Don't go anywhere. We'll have more with Dr. Fabrizio Michelazzi, the Lewis Atterbury Stimson Professor and Chairman of the Department of Surgery at the Weill Medical College of Cornell University. I'm Dr. Philip Stieg, and you're listening to How to Save Your Life. Welcome back. to How to Save Your Life. I'm Dr. Philip Stieg, and I'm talking with Dr. Fabrizio Michelazzi, the Lewis Atterbury Stimson Professor and Chairman of the Department of Surgery at the Weill Medical College of Cornell University. Again, it's a pleasure to have you here, Fabrizio, and I wanted to direct the conversation now to a topic that has gained significant notoriety in the New York arena after the death of one of our prominent citizens from colon cancer. You know, as I understand it, it may be linked or kind of merged together when you refer to colorectal cancer. Is there a difference both in terms of the symptoms and then the prognosis? And you know, we'll get into some of the questions about ethnicity and that, but you know, what is the difference between colon cancer and rectal cancer?
Well, they're both cancers of the large intestine. The large intestine is the lower part of our intestine. It is probably about 5 feet long, and the last 5 inches are called the rectum. So if a cancer originates and grows in the last 5 inches, it's a rectal cancer. If it is outside of those 5 inches but still in the large intestine, it's called a colon cancer. Now, it seems like almost what's the difference? Well, the difference is major because, first of all, the treatments are different. The symptoms are different. And a rectal cancer, as we all know, carries the possibility, which in good hands nowadays is less and less, that the patient may require a permanent stoma, which means a permanent bag on the outside to discharge waste and stool. So patients and the population in general are much more afraid of a rectal cancer than a colon cancer.
What's the difference in, you said earlier about the prognosis between the two. What does it mean to a person that has colon cancer versus rectal cancer?
Rather than prognosis, I was actually referring to the symptoms. Symptoms are different. And if you have a colon cancer, say on the right side of the colon, the right side means nearby the appendix and so forth, those are really silent tumors. And usually they manifest themselves because they ooze blood in the intestine and patients become anemic, which means with a low circulating blood. Most of them are more tired than usual because they're losing blood on a constant basis. And that's usually the patient that comes to the emergency room or to the attention of the physician with this kind of aspecific problems. On the left side, on the other hand, where the colon is smaller in size, a tumor can actually block the intestine. And so patients are more likely to have symptoms associated with the difficulty in passing bowel movements. When it comes down to the rectum, it's more of a pressure down at the bottom of the pelvis, like when patients are constipated and they cannot really have a bowel movement, it's the same kind of pressure. There may be some blood on the toilet paper. Patients notice first. And so the symptoms are very, very different. When tumors are resected, they're removed surgically, whether they're in the colon or in the rectum, the prognosis, which means the long-term outlook on life and on curability, is the same, whether it is in the colon or the rectum. Although surgically it's much more difficult to remove a rectal cancer than a colon cancer.
So we'll get a little bit into the prognosis a little bit later, but one of the things that I think concerns everybody is, you know, what you read in the newspaper, that all of a sudden somebody has it and it just happens so quickly. Are there behavioral things that we do that lead to an increased risk for developing either of these cancers? Are there behavioral things that we can do for early detection? And is there a genetic component?
Yeah, those are very good questions. Let me try to address each one of them. First of all, there have been many, many, many studies trying to tie one particular kind of diet to the chances of developing colon cancer or a rectal cancer, with the exclusion of the influence of smoking on increasing the chances for a colon cancer, the same way smoking increases the chances of a pancreatic cancer or a lung cancer and so forth. There have been very conflicting data on specific diets having a higher incidence or producing a higher chance of developing a colorectal cancer. We believe, but again, data are conflicting, that if you have a high-fat diet and low in vegetables and roughage, you're a higher risk of developing a colon cancer than if you have a diet that is rich in vegetables and salads and very low in fat. But
just a quick aside, is there any correlation then between the Atkins diet and colorectal cancer?
Well, I don't know of any paper that has looked at that specific issue, and so I can't really answer the question. But I think that probably the best possible thing that you can do to try, maybe not to prevent the colorectal cancer, but to detect it when it's curable, is really to undergo colonoscopies. And
when do you start those?
The guidelines nowadays indicate that you should start at age 50 and have your first colonoscopy at age 50. And if the colon looks pristine, have it every 5 to 10 years.
And that's both for men and women?
Yeah. If there are polyps, those polyps can be removed so that, because we know that polyps eventually grow into cancers.
And a polyp is a...
It's like a growth, a benign growth. It's not a cancer, but it's a benign growth. Now, you asked before about the genetics, and this is very important. In the last 10-15 years, there has been a revelation of how some of these tumors are really based on the genetic makeup that we inherit. There's probably about a 1 or 2 or 3% of all these tumors who really have a very strong genetic predisposition, for which if you know if your mother or father had a specific condition that we call familial polyposis, you will probably develop familial polyposis, and all those patients by age, say, 40, the majority by age 40, they've developed a colon cancer. But there's also a larger amount of percentage of individuals, maybe as many as 5 to 10%, with a strong family history of colon cancer, where although we may not know yet exactly what is the genetic composition that leads them to develop colon cancer, we know that they're higher risk. And for this particular patient, the recommendation to have their colonoscopy is not at 50 as the first colonoscopy, but actually is earlier, at 40. To try to detect the earlier changes of a colon cancer.
To try to, number one, motivate people for what I think a lot of people have an image of it being an unpleasant experience, the colonoscopy. First question is, you know, how common is this colorectal cancer? And then can you alleviate the fears about a colonoscopy? Is it, you know, something you can go back to work the same day, or what does it involve?
Well, in terms of the incidence of colorectal cancer, it is estimated that this year there will be something like 150,000, 160,000 new cancers in the United States, which practically makes 1 in 2,000.
It's a high number.
It's a high number. And it's obviously 1 in 2,000, and the mean age for diagnosis of colon cancer is, say, 65 to 70. So I think that it's not 1 in 2,000 when you're 10 or 20 or 25. It's certainly 1 in 2,000 and actually even higher when you are in the later age. And so I think that it just needs to be done. Simple as that. Now, can you go back to work the same day? Yes. You can have your colonoscopy, say, at 8:30 in the morning, and by 12 or 1 o'clock you can be in your office and can do whatever needs to be done. What is unpleasant, we all know that. It's the preparation for the colonoscopy to clean your intestine rather than the colonoscopy itself, because the colonoscopy itself is done under sedation. And so most of nowadays we have such wonderful sedatives given intravenously that patients don't even remember that they had a colonoscopy.
So let's take it a step further then. You do a colonoscopy and you see a growth and a person needs their surgery. What does that entail, and is surgery all they get, or then do they go on to other types of therapy as well?
I think at this point it's very important to first talk about colon cancer and then rectal cancer. In colon cancer, the first step, unless unfortunately you have demonstrated that the tumor is already spread to other sites, but that's not frequently the case, fortunately, the first step is surgery. you know, it doesn't take Einstein to figure out that a tumor is better out than in. So the first step is surgery. Once the tumor has been removed and has been brought to the attention of the pathologist can look under the microscope and see how early or how advanced the tumor is. And conventional wisdom nowadays is that if the tumor is confined to the wall of the intestine, in general, you do not need anything else. But if it has spread to the lymph nodes nearby, there have been studies done in the 90s which have demonstrated that appropriate chemotherapy can reduce the chances of a recurrence of the tumor and increase the outlook at 5, 10 years and the survival rate. So those patients should undergo chemotherapy in addition to a surgery and after having recovered from the surgery.
Are there minimally invasive ways to do this surgery now with little endoscopes or that, or is that for other types of surgery?
No, this is just fine. And the minimally invasive surgery, which started in the late 80s by removing gallbladders, extended to the colon in the early 90s. And so by now, some of us have experience with 10, 15 years of minimally invasive surgery for colon cancer, and it has been demonstrated over and over again, if it's done appropriately, the results are the same in terms of survival rate and outcome, and actually the surgery is less invasive, and patients recover faster from the surgery.
So from a consumer standpoint then, you know, 20 years ago after you used to have bowel surgery or abdominal surgery, you were laid up for how long? And now with minimally invasive surgery, how fast do you get back to work?
Well, I think that nowadays, certainly still not a walk in the park, but it's much better than 20 years ago. 20 years ago, you would be in the hospital for probably 10 days after the surgery and probably 3 days before the surgery. Nowadays, you come the morning of surgery, and most of the times you go home within 3 to 5 days. And this is due to an appreciation for avoiding unnecessary trauma, whether you do it through minimally invasive approaches or conventional surgery, but limiting the incisions, limiting the trauma to the patient, and also because we have better ways of carrying patients through surgery, through anesthesia, and in the immediate postoperative days. So I see many patients going home 3 days after the surgery, 4 or 5 days after the surgery, and then recovering at home satisfactorily. And if it's done in a minimally invasive way, I would say that within 3 weeks, patients have recovered as much as, say, 80 to 90% of the preoperative stamina and strength.
And are able to get back to their...
Yeah, work.
Relatively routine activities.
Now, you asked me before about rectal cancer. Let's not forget about that because it's a totally different kettle of fish.
Yeah.
Rectal cancer is much more difficult to handle because it's deep in the pelvis. And the pelvis has many, many different structures which are so important, both the bladder, obviously urinating in the male, but also in the female. The sexual function may be affected by an operation on the rectum. The confines of the pelvis, meaning it's a small space, so you really need to develop appropriate techniques to take care of this. In general, in rectal cancer, besides surgery and chemotherapy, which we talked about for colon cancer, there is another modality that we can use, which is the radiation therapy. And so I think that a surgeon or an oncologist have to figure out whether we go directly, send the patient directly to surgery, or pre-treat that tumor with radiation and chemotherapy before going to surgery with the hope of shrinking the cancer and allowing for an easier resection.
I think any time a patient hears the word cancer, you know, it starts to be pretty scary for them. And it sounds like you have to differentiate between colon cancer and rectal cancer. If they get that diagnosis, what is the prognosis? How well are they going to live? How long are they going to live with a colon cancer versus a rectal cancer?
It really depends on the stage of the tumor, of the cancer. And traditionally, we have divided the stage in four stages. Either the very initial one, stage one, or the one with, unfortunately, liver metastasis or spread, which is stage four. And then you have in between those two stages is stage 2, when the tumor is confined just to the intestine, and stage 3 when it has gone to the nearby lymph nodes. Depending on this stage, the survival can be 100% of 5 years, or if you have, unfortunately, stage 4 where the tumor has already gone to the liver or to other locations, the survival is obviously not as rosy, and it's all a question, therefore, of the stage of the tumor.
When we're talking about 5-year survival, just for the listeners, and if they survive 5 years, that's usually then considered a cure?
Yeah, especially for stage 1 and stage 2 is considered a cure, and even for stage 3 is approximates that definition.
You know, I mean, the patient hears that they've got this stage 4 cancer. What challenges do you face as a physician in breaking that both to the patient and to the family? I mean, how do you work with them? How do you ease the stress that's associated with all this?
Well, first of all, I think you have to assess the full situation. Just because someone has stage 4 cancer, which means, again, that the tumor has gone outside of the intestine and to distant organs, it doesn't mean that you have to throw the towel. Frequently, we do concomitant resections of the colon and or the rectum and, say, a liver metastasis. The goal is to remove all visible tumor. And if you do that, I think that patients have a fair shot at a long-term survival, especially when nowadays we have additional good chemotherapy, radiation therapy. So I think that that is the first goal of an examining physician, in trying to figure out how to save and how to cure as many patients as possible. If cure, on the other hand, is not feasible, I think at that point you have to do everything to lengthen life and improve quality of life.
But what I'm hearing from you is today, we as physicians, or you as a physician in this specific disease category, can be much more hopeful and positive about their long-term outlook.
Absolutely, and I think that there are many bad actors there. Unfortunately, colon cancer and rectal cancer are not as bad as other cancers. And so I think that with the techniques that we have developed today, with the chemotherapy that we have today, with the expertise that we have today, I think that this is one of the most or more amenable tumors.
But early detection is probably the most important thing.
It is absolutely key.
Yeah. So we got to get everybody down age 50 now to get your
age 50, absolutely. And I think that the issue with the rectal cancer that we were touched upon before is that in that case, not only you want to achieve cure, but you also want to minimize potential side effects on the urinary bladder and on the sexual function. And so I think that in the case of rectal cancer, it is imperative that the surgeon who deals with those patients is very prepared and cognizant to address every single issue, not only just the rectal cancer.
I want to focus on how to find the right surgeon when we come back. We'll be right back with Dr. Fabrizio Michelazzi after this short break. You are listening to How to Save Your Life. Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. I'm Dr. Philip Stieg, and I'm talking with Dr. Fabrizio Michelazzi, the Lewis Atterbury Stimson Professor and Chairman of the Department of Surgery at Weill Medical College of Cornell University. And we've been talking about some serious diseases, colon cancer and rectal cancer. Certainly, if I was given that diagnosis, I'd be frightened out of my mind, and I'd want to be reassured that I could find a good doctor. Fabrizio, how does a patient go about selecting the right doctor and making sure that they're in good hands?
Well, I guess it's the same way. How do you find a good lawyer? How do you find a good professional and so forth? Definitely want to make sure that in terms of a good surgeon, the surgeon is certified and maintains active certification. And that is public knowledge on the internet and so forth. Second, I think you want to make sure that that particular surgeon does a large volume of treating the disease that you have or the condition that you have. Nowadays, we're going more and more toward the assessment of the results and having actually the results being of public knowledge. The cardiac surgeons have done it for many, many years in the state of New York, but I believe also that soon general surgeon will be required to show that data, their results. In the absence of that, you want to be assured that the surgeon has good results either by word of mouth or by checking on the internet and see whether the particular surgeon has published or has talked extensively about the condition that you're being diagnosed. I think it's also very important to recognize that this is not the work of a single. It's not just the work of a surgeon. A surgeon needs to work in a structure, in a hospital that is first rate and first class, because again, the surgeon will need a good anesthesiologist, they will need good ICUs, a good pathologist, good radiologist, and everything else that makes the treatment and the care of the patient as smooth as possible.
Yeah, I get asked all the time, when the patient asks the question, how many of these a year do you do for this type of disease process, what's a good number that they should hear?
Well, difficult to say a specific number, but I think that when you're talking about colorectal cancer, the individual should at least do 40 or 50 a year, in my opinion. And if you go to a surgeon who has done 40 or 50 a year for the past 20 or 30 years, I think that you should be in pretty good hands.
Great. I want to change track here a little bit and talk about a disease that may be equally as debilitating. My dog actually has this disease, and I can find that it's
don't send me your dog.
It's a mess to clean up, and it's Crohn's disease. Fortunately, my dog can't communicate with me when he's having difficulties. You know, what is Crohn's disease? It's there's Crohn's Society out there. It's thrown in the newspaper on a pretty regular basis.
Crohn's disease is a chronic inflammation of the intestine. It may affect any parts of the intestine, practically from mouth down to the anus. Usually, it affects most commonly the small bowel, but it can also affect the large bowel. It can also affect the stomach. It's a chronic inflammation that manifests itself in many different ways. Probably the two more common ways are either with obstructions, which means that the food doesn't travel with ease through the intestine, or the other way with infections, with abscesses, with perforations, in other words, blowouts, with communication between the intestine and other organs.
So a person just doesn't come into you complaining about, I got a little bit of heartburn. I mean, from what you're describing, they've got some fairly significant symptoms.
Yeah, frequently they come to me after they've been treated by a gastroenterologist for a long time because the first treatment for Crohn's disease is usually medical. And when the medical treatment does not alleviate the symptoms of the patients or fails to do so, at that point the patient is sent to the surgeon.
So what kind of medical treatment do they undergo?
Well, the medical treatment has varied and has changed dramatically in the last 20 years. 20, 30 years ago, the mainstay of medical treatment was prednisone and cortisone. But nowadays, there are much more refined medications, either immunomodulators. These are medications that modulate the immune response, or biologicals that are affecting specific portion of the biological cycle of the cell. and much more targeted therapy nowadays than 30 years ago. It's a very complex field, and even in this case, you know, before you ask me how do I choose a surgeon, in this particular case, you really have to choose an experienced gastroenterologist who has substantial experience in this condition.
So you're using more than three-syllable words here with immunomodulators. To me, that just brings up the concept of some genetic component. Is that part of the disease process?
Yeah, it's been known for forever that if you take a patient with Crohn's disease and you ask whether members of his or her family have been affected by Crohn's disease or by a similar condition called ulcerative colitis, as many as 10% of members have inflammatory bowel disease, which means either Crohn's or ulcerative colitis, pointing to a strong genetic component. And in the last probably 5 to 10 years, there's been some elucidation of what genetics most likely are, although it is so complex that most likely is beyond just one gene, and it is not completely clear at this point how the genetics really work in Crohn's disease.
You know, my medical knowledge stopped a few years ago in terms of this disease, and you know, it stopped with prednisone as a therapy, which was rather a miserable existence for the patient.
Absolutely.
Are these new medicines much more, are they more effective, number one, and number two, are they better tolerated by the patient?
Definitely. They're better tolerated, and they are more effective. And I think that the majority of patients with Crohn's disease can be treated, at least for long periods of time, medically. Over the course of a life, on the other hand, the chances of requiring surgery are certainly more than 50%.
That high. And when they come to surgery, now with these new techniques that you've played a part in developing, you know, how big a deal is that?
Well, I think that the concept of surgery in Crohn's disease has been changing in the last 25 years. While 25 years or 30 years ago, the idea was to resect the Crohn's disease, which was just fine, and patients were made better right away. That approach was really not cognizant of the fact that this, unfortunately, is a recurrent disease. And so if you end up resecting more and more intestine at different operations, sooner or later you end up having not enough intestine. And so in the last 25 years, many different procedures have been developed, which on one hand alleviate the symptoms of the Crohn's disease, and by the same time also save intestine. These are called bowel-sparing or bowel-saving procedures, and in technical terms are called strictoplasties. And I think that patients with Crohn's disease should be, in my opinion, be taken care of by surgeons who, when they require surgery, by surgeons who are, again, very cognizant of these new techniques, which allow, again, to address the symptoms and the problems that the patients have, and at the same time save as much bowel as possible.
Does a patient with this disease have a relatively normal life? Can they play sports? Can they have children? You know, do all those things?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that obviously not during the acute phases of the disease when patients do require either intense medical treatment or surgery, but both the medical treatment and the surgical treatment should aim to restore quality of life to these patients. And quality of life, in my book, means a normal life, playing sports, having family, and so forth.
I know we've been talking about some serious diseases here, colon cancer, rectal cancer, Crohn's disease, and I hope that the listeners are hearing that there is optimism at the end of the diagnosis for each of these diseases. And I wanted to move on briefly into another very serious disease process called pancreatic cancer. What does the pancreas do, and why is it such a bad cancer?
Well, the pancreas is a gland that has two functions. One is the function of producing hormones, the most commonly known is the insulin, to maintain the glucose, circulating glucose at the normal level. But also the pancreas is responsible for producing enzymes such as the amylase and lipase, which really help digest our food. So it has two functions. And sometimes this organ, like practically every organ in our body, may develop a cancer, and a pancreatic cancer.
So since it's an organ that's so linked to just sort of our metabolic internal life, Are there things that we eat and drink that make us more susceptible to pancreatic cancer?
Again, as I said before, with the exception of smoking, that we know increases the risk of pancreatic cancer like it increases the risk of practically every cancer known, there is very little to link diet or other habits with the insurgence of pancreatic cancer.
So since it's not a mechanical organ like the colon and that moves on a daily basis, what's the patient going to sense, or what symptoms might they have if they have pancreatic cancer?
It's another one of those silent tumors, at least until a certain point when they maybe block the flow of bile from the liver to the intestine, and patients develop jaundice. In other words, they develop yellowness in their skin and so forth. Up to that point, unfortunately, these tumors are pretty silent, and they can grow without giving many symptoms, except maybe some symptoms of not feeling well or losing some weight and not having the usual appetite.
Is this a tumor that we usually pick up early or pick up later in the disease process?
I think that nowadays, with the fact that pancreatic cancer has been at the forefront of the news in the past 10 years several times, there is an increased awareness of it. And with better imaging, such as the CAT scan that we have today, the MRIs that we have today, we're able to pick up these tumors earlier than, say, 10, 15, 20 years ago.
You mentioned CAT scans and MRI scans. You know, there are some people out there marketing the whole concept of the total body scan. What are your thoughts about that? Would it be useful in picking up something like this? Where should that sort of thing go? Should insurance companies start to pay for it?
Well, this is obviously something that we cannot solve on your program, Phil, in the next 2 minutes. But obviously there is the advantage of getting a picture, a total body picture, and to a certain extent many individuals may be lured by that promise that with one picture you can detect many things. You and I know that every time we take a picture, no matter how good they are, we may discover things that are normal, but they are not consistent with how they usually look. They may require additional workup. They may require additional procedures and so forth. It's a fine balance between what you're going to pick up on this blind scans, blind meaning done without a particular suspicion in mind, and the inconvenience to the patients, the cost of doing it, and potentially also the complications that may come from these studies. So I don't think that yet there is a good answer on how advantageous this screening CAT scans are or screening MRIs are.
So you deal with some pretty tough diseases on a day-to-day basis. You know, they don't have friendly-sounding names. Have you ever seen a miracle?
Oh, I think that I see miracles every day. Because, first of all, our imaging, our CAT scan abilities, our MRI abilities, our diagnosing abilities are much better now than 20 years ago. Second, our surgery is much more refined today than it used to be in the past. The minimal invasive surgery, the better anesthesia, better ICU treatments, and so forth. And better chemotherapeutic agents when it comes to cancer. So I think nowadays we are achieving better results and much better results than 20 or 30 years ago. And on top of that, in the past 5 to 10 years, there has been a lot of attention on quality of life, which means that not only you want to cure patients, but you want to maintain them as good as they are and return them to life as complete as possible. So I think that there is a lot of optimism nowadays, both in GI cancers as well as in Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis and so forth, and a lot of knowledge that we have accrued in the past two decades.
Yeah, we've mentioned a couple of times how serious the problems are that you deal with on a daily basis. How do you cope? How do you stay happy? How do you stay upbeat? What do you do to keep yourself getting up in the morning?
Oh, I think that you're a surgeon as well, so you know that we are lucky to be able to operate on a problem, solve the problem, see the patient going home, see the patient coming back to your office in 2 weeks, and know that you have really impacted positively on that particular patient. And I think that that is a constant reminder of, no matter how tough the problems are, that we can really change for the better the course of a patient's life.
Compassion is an important part of your practice.
Oh, I think that that is extremely important. I'm reminded that if you go to the American College of Surgeons headquarters in Chicago, there is a painting from about 100 years ago where the only thing you see is a country doctor. Obviously, they didn't have antibiotics. They didn't have the surgery that we have today. And this doctor is at the bedside of a sick patient. But you see that compassion already is so important for that patient that is at the base of our profession. And I think that we can only build on top of the compassion with the modern treatments that we have today.
Well, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you for spending this past hour with us and educating the listeners to how they can better manage severe problems involving their stomach and their intestinal tract. As I said, it's been a true pleasure and honor to have Fabrizio Michelozzi, the Lewis Atterbury Stimson Professor and Chairman of the Department of Surgery at the Weill Medical College of Cornell University, on our program, How to Save Your Life. Thank you again, Fabrizio.
Thank you very much, Phil.